welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, vaccination, religious liberty, and public health. And Richard, this topic in the news lately because we are seeing outbreaks of measles this year at a rate not seen in decades. It's becoming a real public health concern all around the country. And a lot of the blame is being directed towards people who don't vaccinate their children, which has led to several fights about how far the government could go to coerce that behavior. So before we even go into some of the current controversies, why don't we start with the history? Where does the government's role in these kinds of issues emerge from, and what's been the history on the legal side?
Okay, well, the obvious place to begin is with the stuff in the 1790s when this fellow Jenner managed to figure out how to turn cowpox into a vaccine for smallpox. And, you know, this was a revolutionary situation where, wholly without any knowledge of how this thing actually worked, what you were able to do was to basically put a huge dent in what was a deadly scourge. And so at the beginning, I think people understood less about the issues associated with religious liberty or with respect to government coercion. And there was just more of a belief that, my heavens, we have this opportunity. Let us take advantage of all of this stuff. Now, it becomes a legal issue in the United States a good deal later. The vaccines are now, shall we say, in the beginning of the research age. And there's a famous Massachusetts case from about 1903 or so, in which Jacobson against Massachusetts, in which the question is whether or not this fellow can resist a vaccination order. And it's a bit of a fake controversy for the following reason. One is the guy had all sorts of reasons to say why it was that he should not be vaccinated. In fact, he had had other vaccinations, had severe reactions to it, and in fact, he thought he was in danger of dying. And one of the things that you have to recognize about vaccines is even if the odds are minuscule that somebody will be adversely affected, it does happen from time to time. And the strongest evidence that it's likely to happen in the future is that it has happened in the past. And so even today, when you have mandatory vaccination statutes, there are some kinds of loopholes to take into account dangers to the health of the party in question. You don't need uniform vaccination in order to control a population. You just have to get it up to a fairly high level so that the number of stragglers who get it will not be sufficiently large that they can spread it from person to person. And if you have 99% of the population cared for, chances are very few people will get the vaccine from the 1%. Now, the interesting thing about Jacobson is it was supposed to be a police-powered place. And they said, look, we believe in liberty, but the prevention of disease to other people is certainly a legitimate government interest. If you go look closely at the facts, what was at issue in this was whether or not the guy had to pay a fine. And as far as I'm concerned, that makes a great case into a trivial case. A $5 fine in order to avoid this kind of a punishment is, for a guy who has a serious condition, absolutely trivial thing to pay. And the risk is that people who don't have any serious conditions will find it a bargain to pay that as well. By the time you got to the 1920s, the situation has changed a little. It wasn't fines that you did, but you'd see a move that's going on today, which is you announce that children who are not vaccinated cannot go to public schools. And the theory here is it's not so much a police power regulation as a schoolhouse regulation, and the government has more power in figuring out how it devotes its surveys and its facilities to other people than it does in topping this stuff. When you start talking about vaccines, then the next thing is after World War II, and I can still remember there were all sorts of pictures of children in schoolrooms lining up to get their vaccinations because everybody thought that the scourges had to be dealt with. And by the time you get Jonas Salk with the Salk vaccine against polio in 1954, vaccines have a somewhat heroic status, but they still have some side effects. And as we start moving on, what happens is the entire skepticism about the pharmaceutical industry, about the purity of drugs, the safety of drugs, the safety of automobiles, starts to coalesce around vaccines. And since, as I mentioned before, there are always adverse cases, the question is, what do you do? So the next round turned out to be the way in which you dealt with certain kinds of vaccines that took place in the wild in the West, the so-called polio vaccine cases. And it turned out that there's a real interesting problem here. which is, it turns out that the vaccine, in a very tiny number of cases, can actually give you the same condition that you get from the wild virus. And there were several cases in which there were mass vaccinations where the vaccine was supplied by the pharmaceutical company, and the local doctor's corps, a hospital or a nurse's corps, administered these things, and somebody got an adverse case. And it was held in several cases, there was actually a jury question as to whether or not it was the wild strain or the vaccine that gave the disease. I could still remember my friend from Chicago, very fine statistician named Paul Meyer, who died some years ago. He looked at me and he was so outraged. He said, the odds are 1,000,000 to 1. Why are you going to let any jury decide that kind of case? But it turns out that the potential liabilities in the vaccine cases really started to drive up the kinds of cost and reduce the availability. And I happen to think that those 1990 or 1970 cases on polio was something of a tragedy in the way in which they were dealing with. Well, then the next kinds of things that you get into is that you start coming into the more modern period, and you're worried about the various vaccines, the compound vaccines that are used for diphtheria, typhoid, mumps, measles, whatever it is. There are a bunch of them. And they're held together by mercury. And all of a sudden, there are large numbers of people who believe that the mercury, in fact, when it binds these vaccines together, can cause autism. And so it's at that point that you get the modern break. And the real breakthrough on this was in 1998, when a very distinguished but now wholly discredited physician named Andrew Wakefield claimed that he had found a positive correlation between the use of these various vaccines and autism. And from that time on, this has been a real tussle with the anti-vaxxers, even though the article, which was published, I believe, in Lancet, has long been discredited and withdrawn. So what we do is we have popular sentiment on one side and an overwhelming weight of scientific consensus on the other.
So some of the flashpoints for this current debate: in New York City right now, they've imposed mandatory vaccinations in parts of Brooklyn because there's a community of Orthodox Jews there that have unusually low rates of vaccination and thus a concentration of measles. You also had, at the same time, because this is happening in other places around the country, certain states like Connecticut and Oregon that are talking about doing away with religious exemptions for vaccines altogether. A few states already don't allow it. How do you react to proposals like these?
Well, I mean, I think they're actually very difficult. And the first question you want to know is the only person who is hurt if, in fact, you deal with the refusal to take vaccine is the party who refuses to take it? I'm willing, under those circumstances, to have a situation in which I'm willing to let it go. But the problem is all of these diseases are contagious. And to the extent that they're contagious, if you make a decision that you don't vaccinate your child and your neighbor does the same thing, there are lots of innocent people who, in fact, are going to be seriously injured. So to give you but one illustration, generally speaking, all of these vaccines cannot be given to newborns. All of these newborns can, in fact, suffer from these kinds of diseases. So do you want to have, you know, several million people each year who are born subject to the kind of risk because people have strong religious exemptions? So my own view on this is I think the religious exemptions are generally fine, but you don't give a religious exemption for somebody who wants to murder somebody in a sacrificial ritual. And I don't think that you should give the religious exemption in this particular case either. It's just the external effects are too large and too devastating, and you cannot basically have everybody else in the population cover themselves by taking the vaccines themselves. So long as there are people who are not susceptible to vaccine, either because they're too young or they have medical conditions, then it seems to me that the state ought to do this. Now, the hard question is, when should it do it? One view says you do it prophylactically, and you never wait until something starts to happen, because many people die in the interim. And there are other people who say, well, you may be below the level of non-vaccination or of people who are not vaccinated, so it's not to have any risk. Wait until that happens. On that issue, I guess I'm more on the hard line side than on the soft side. Why is that? Because we now have seen with the measles situation the way it's going to play out, and I have every confidence, sadly, that exactly the same kind of play out will take place if, in fact, what you do is you have some other kind of disease or some other kind of condition. And so what I believe with respect to the police power is it certainly only covers matter of health and safety. I'm very much against giving broad definitions to what counts as health and what counts as safety. You have all sorts of fanciful things that can be just abuses for anti-competitive times of situation. But death by measles, serious injury by other kinds of diseases, is not the sort of thing that doesn't that you can say, oh, well, that's not really a health risk. So I guess, you know, as a libertarian, my attitude is, the government should do relatively few things, but where it does have the kind of power to deal with these sorts of issues, that is, in ends of this particular case, then I think it ought to have sensible means in order to do that. And I don't see, at least at this particular point in time, a less restrictive, sensible alternative than sort of mandating the vaccine, notwithstanding the religious objections. It's obviously a very, very tough call. It will be a legislative issue, I suspect. But I don't believe in this particular case that the claim of religious liberty will end up being strong enough to have constitutional significance.
One of the things you hear about the situation in New York City, where a lot of the problem is these Orthodox Jews in Williamsburg, is that there's actually no real – this is what people will say – there's actually no real prescription against vaccination in their faith. This is kind of a cultural practice that they've taken up. Richard, is a factor like that material in a legal fight, that this is the adopted practice of a subset of religious individuals as opposed to some core doctrinal point? In other words, for the purposes of law, is a religious practice just whatever a group of religious people do?
It's a very fair question. I mean, the answer is obviously it does not help the claim for religious liberty to say that it is not required by any kind of formal religious faith. If it were on the other side, then there would be a genuine tension. But by and large, for the most part, I think the correct attitude is to say we're not in the business at the center and trying to tell people what or how their religious beliefs ought to be done. The freedom of religion doesn't only apply to people who live in Orthodox sects and are governed by specific codes. It covers anybody with genuine religious beliefs associated with the deity. Justice Scalia said in the only sensible part in his terrible opinion in Smith, that is the case, which said all we require to protect religious liberty is non-discrimination. He said, I don't want to get into the business of figuring out what religious beliefs are. I happen to think that's right. And it's right even under the circumstances where it turns out you're trying to figure out what kind of accommodations you make. Because the Smith position that Justice Scalia took was one which said, if you give vaccines to people who have no religious belief, then a neutral application of that law to people with religious beliefs is just fine. And I think that's wildly overbroad. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act was designed to undo that, and to some extent did, and to some extent did not. But I would say I would do two things. One is I would say I think that these sect beliefs, so long as they're sincerely held, would count as religious freedom. But since I'm not prepared to recognize religious freedom even when it's come from an Orthodox text in accordance with a very rigid protocol of religious beliefs, I'm certainly not going to give a better position to these wayward religions than I am to the core religions. I'm going to treat them more or less as the same, in line with that particular insight from Justice Scalia.
Talk to me about how this argument changes after we pull it out of the realm of religion, because a lot of the action on the anti-vax side in recent years hasn't really come from religious groups so much as parents who, as you mentioned, they claim it has some kind of link to autism, or ones who just sort of dislike it for lifestyle reasons. So if the argument is, I just don't want the vaccines, and it has nothing to do with God, but it does stem from a sincere and deeply held belief, what kind of footing are you on at that point?
Well, I mean, from my view, is you're on the same footing as somebody who has a strong religious belief. The basic difficulty with the religion clauses is always you create some degree of exceptionalism for religious beliefs that you don't give to somebody else, and then you get yourself into the famous constitutional trap. Oh, you give special preferences, now you satisfy the free exercise clause. Oh, you give special preferences, now you're in violation of the establishment clause. So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And what I would say is exactly the same point. I'm certainly willing to have all sorts of scientific evidence of one kind or another come in to see whether or not these are actually legitimate concerns. If it turns out that you actually look at these studies, and there have been a number of cases at it, the evidence seems to be simply overwhelming about this. So let me just mention, it's kind of one of the weird contradictions. When you start looking at this in the Centers for Disease Control, everybody, when they start looking at the studies, say, we are not going to give anybody compensation for any condition that they claim is caused by a vaccine. Because remember, under these vaccine statutes today, in order to soften product liability law, there's a rule which says that if you can show a close connection between what the vaccine did and what you had, you're entitled to compensation wholly without regard to fault by the manufacturer. These were introduced after the swine flu problem of the 1970s because you couldn't get any company to supply vaccines if everybody is going to be responsible. Guillain-Barré syndrome was one of the things that did this. And so what you did is you established a compensation fund, broader compensation on the one hand, but lower compensation, but easier standards of proof. Now, nobody has ever recovered any money from the fund with respect to a vaccine-related industry, at least the last time I looked at this. Things may have changed some. But what is very odd in this particular situation is that the government now says, well, we're not really sure what's going on, so maybe we should not put the three vaccines together, DBT, and so on, because they may have this kind of a problem. I regard that as absolutely madness. It seems to me, if you know what the scientific evidence is, the moment you decide to say we're not going to use a three-in-one vaccine, what it means in effect is that young children are going to be put at a risk for a longer period of time, because you first give the one shot, then you have to wait a few weeks before you give the second one, and wait a little bit longer before you give the third. People will forget one, they won't do the second, or whatever it turns out to be. And what you're doing is you're creating a much more porous system. And so if you really believe that there's absolutely no case whatsoever for giving compensation, then there's no case whatsoever for banning the practice, which has never caused any kind of harm. And I actually wrote about that some years ago, and I still regard this whole debate as kind of surrealistic. So the bottom line can be summarized in one sentence. There are very few things I want the government to do. But when it turns out there's a peril to life and liberty, those are amongst the things that governments ought to do, and that we ought not to accept weak scientific arguments based upon personal whims and preferences. That would be just fine if you're only concerning your own child, but it's not fine when you're concerning other children. And so, for example, I don't feel quite the same way about Christian Scientists who refuse to get treatment for their own children because they're not threatening anybody else. But interestingly enough, even in that case, it's a very weird dynamic. Is many, for example, Christian Scientists are opposed to having any medical intervention to remove bowel obstructions in young children, which will kill you, and it's a simple operation to get rid of it. But the way in which the game plays, I am told, is the doctors say, you must have this, and then the parents say, we will not do it. The doctor then says, I will get a court order. The parent will say, get your court order. And then all of a sudden the parents disappear and the operation gets done. Why is that? Because the psychology is the Christian Scientists often, or so I am told, don't want to have their acknowledgement of the treatment, but they want their children to live, so they're willing to let the injunction take it out of their control and out of their hands. That's a very different set of problems from the one that we have with vaccines in connection with contagion.
So the final question that I'll ask you, some libertarian thinkers and even a libertarian political figure, I guess, Rand Paul, have said that regardless of the merits of the vaccines, and I guess implicitly the effects on others, making them compulsory violates the non-aggression principle, which is the philosophical touchstone for a lot of libertarians, the idea that you shouldn't use force against others unless it's in retaliation or self-defense. Now, based on what you said earlier, I'm guessing you would say that this is a misunderstanding of the non-aggression principle because there actually is a high likelihood of harm here. But what do you make of the broader argument here that the non-aggression principle really is and ought to be the first principle of libertarianism? Is that how you think about it?
Well, I think of it as the first, but not as the only. With respect to the application of the principle, non-aggression is, in fact, much more difficult to unpack than you might think. So the first thing we say is, of course, you cannot use force to attack somebody else. And so the sly person who knows what the libertarian believes about force and aggression says, I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is dig a hole in the ground, put a bunch of spears in the bottom, cover it up with dirt, and when somebody falls in and gets themselves impaled on these things, I'm going to say, I didn't do it. It was his step and gravity that did it, so therefore absolve me of responsibility. That argument has been made from ancient times, and there's not a single legal system on the face of the globe which does not have what in Roman law, we have to get back to that topic again, called causa mortis per stares, furnishing a cause of death, setting a trap or something like that, are always treated as the use of force. And then we also have the law of nuisance. It's not the use of force in an obvious way to let dangerous gases go into the air and then the wind blow them onto your neighbor's plot of land where they destroy the plants and kill people in the house. And yet nuisance has been a tort from Roman times on forward because the intervention of natural elements which are predictable and regular and commonplace never sever causal connection. Well, contagion is like all of these kinds of cases. So the non-aggression principle applies to them. The complexity is one that most libertarians just don't think very hard about, is what do you do in cases of uncertainty? So you, in fact, go out there and you drive your car. You don't mean aggression, but you're a very bad driver. And you have a 10% chance of killing somebody anytime you go on the highway. Can we stop you and take away the 90% of the times in which you're going to be perfectly harmless in order to prevent the 10% murder rate? Well, you calculate what a 10% murder rate or killing rate does on the highways, and do you think the United States is prepared to live with 3 million casualties a week? And so you say, yes, we'll stop these 10% people from doing that, even though more likely than not they won't do it. So Rand Paul is, I can't even begin to describe, he sort of knows something about libertarianism, but the lack of systematic thought on this stuff always makes me groan and wince. So that's the first part. The second part, he's also wrong. It's not only aggression that is the sole source of government power. There's this huge collective action problem, providing common facilities, dealing with common pool issues, dealing with the antitrust laws and monopolization of one form or another, organizing and regulating natural monopolies and common carriers and so forth. The entire history of the United States, in many ways, has been a history of small government types finally recognizing that the hardline libertarian non-aggression principle is a sufficient condition for regulation, but it is not a necessary position for regulation. What you then have to do is to think much harder about the kinds of things you're willing to intervene on. And here the Ron Paul point and the Rand Paul point makes a certain degree of sense. They say if you go beyond the non-aggression principles, then the government can do everything. And so what the non-libertarian classical liberal like myself does is no, it means you don't understand how you determine social welfare measures. So what are you supposed to do? When you start thinking about coercion on individuals, if it's part of a systematic program which creates a net overall social improvement, and B, part of that benefit goes to the individual who's subject to the coercion. Then, in effect, what you do is you say that this particular application of force, this particular regulation is justified on the grounds that it leaves everybody subject to it better off than they were before. That is an absolutely essential principle with respect to overall regulation. Rand Paul has never acknowledged that particular principle. And so what he does is he just sounds, to my mind, downright silly. Immature. It's hard to describe it. The most difficult thing I have as a libertarian, it frustrates me more than anything else, is to have somebody take the system and misapply it. And then I am supposed to basically be the intellectual godfather, as Cass Sunstein once described me, of Rand Paul, when I'm not. The man is right on some things. I don't wish to deny that. But in terms of his general overall philosophical sophistication, this is yet another illustration of why it is that the hardline libertarian principles are not an organized and sensible set of principles for dealing with constitutional governance.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.